Well, thanks everybody for being here. I'm going to welcome Tim back from his travels.
Nice to be back.
Yeah, and want to wish Bob good health and a fast recovery. I know some of you had intended to be out there tonight, so hopefully next year we'll be able to sit in the Cedar Grove again. So I spent quite a bit of time this past year working on the kleshas myself. And klesha, first of all, is a Pali term for poisons or defilements. And what these are mental or emotional states, and they cloud the mind and create obstacles to practice. They can be mental, they can be emotional. So just as they say, they're poisons or defilements. And the Buddha spoke about specifically five hindrances specifically to practice, and I'll just review those. Most of you are probably pretty familiar with them, and some of you aren't. Just real fast. First one is greed or desire, and the second one is aversion or ill will and extreme hatred. The third one they call sloth and torpor, which are kind of funny words. So you can interpret that as laziness or inertia or dullness. And then there's restlessness and worry, and the last one is doubt. So in the Pali Canon, these were traditionally taught as impediments to meditation practice, but we can also apply them to our everyday life in general. But the one I want to talk about tonight is doubt. And I sort of came by this unexpectedly. I had, a few weeks ago anyway, I got up early in the morning and I just started writing, and I had written about, 8 pages or whatever, and when I went back and looked at it, I thought, this is about doubt. And it's something I had sort of overlooked when I was going through the rest of the obstacles, and so I guess I need to study this. So what you're hearing are my reflections and then a couple of words from some other people too. So doubt can be either both beneficial or harmful, first of all. But first I'm going to tackle the debilitating side effects of doubt. I've read that it's often the greatest block to our spiritual understanding, even more so than greed or aversion, as it tends to kind of ignite all the other ones. I mean, if there's doubt happening, then that's going to infuse any other hindrance that you're working with, probably. And that may be where it starts. So it can result in indecisiveness, a lack of focus, and general confusion. All of which really lead to an inability to commit, to really commit and to probe any particular path over time and with some determination. And I think we would all be aware of this, so that it really does take time and determination to understand anything that we're going to study at all. You know, if we dabble and we wander around from interest to interest or buffeted around by our likes and dislikes, we will probably accumulate a lot of information, maybe. But we won't really understand anything with real depth. So over time, doubt can diminish our confidence in ourselves and our capacities and our trust in the practice and even in the world around us. And at its worst, our confusion can lead to paralysis and depression. So doubt has, as well as kind of these emotional effects, it also has cognitive effects. It can really begin to tyrannize our thinking. And because this hindering doubt is often characterized by strong opinions and judgments, it tends towards what I'm calling overgeneralizing. For instance, if we're having difficulty with something in our daily life or our practice, doubt can translate these experiences that we're having into broad and vague statements and ways of interpreting the experience. So I'll use my job as an example. I work with young people in the high school with behavioral disabilities and developmental disabilities. So I might be having a hard time someday with a student, which happens frequently. And I could describe the situation just as it happened and say, I had difficulties with a student yesterday. You know, he lost his temper and it just took me hours to get him back on track. Or I might generalize. And I might say, I really suck at this job. And these kids are never going to get it right. I might say that about them. I could, you know, put it on myself, you know, and say that I'm doing a lousy job. Or I just might say, you know, these kids are hopeless. And my staff is hopeless. Nobody came to help me. And if I continue to think this way, eventually I'd start identifying myself and others with these kind of all or nothing stories, which eventually grow into life stories that us are disempowering, you know, for ourselves and for other people we're projecting them on. So these stories prevent us really from gaining any insight into our problems and their solutions, and from recognizing as well our own real actual limitations and capabilities. And then they just create more confusion, you know, and things just begin to cycle around and around. So I certainly have had plenty of opportunities to watch my own stories that have grown out of self-doubt. And I have learned about this doubt that it's characterized by comparison. Really, the whole construction of self is based on comparison when you start to think about it. But with this doubt, there's in a sense a social yardstick, I've called it, applied to and interfering, really obstructing, all relationships. When we are in a relationship with a person, or perhaps we meet somebody at a party or wherever, there's this really, you know, maybe subliminal, maybe more conscious, thing that happens where we're measuring ourselves up with this person. You know, what's this person better at than I am? You know, am I less than this person, more than this person? You know, maybe we're the same. And generally, you know, if we think we're the same, then maybe we get along really well. But this doubt, based on that, really begins and ends in separation as opposed to intimacy with this other person. So it can be really pretty destructive in that way. So now, if we look at practice, how might that be affected by doubt? Well, in the art tradition, in the Mahayana teachings, there is this understanding of Buddha nature, as we call it. In Shambhala, I know they call it basic goodness, which is kind of a nice, simple definition for it. And this is a very foundational teaching about our essential wholeness and our clarity of heart and mind. And with this principle as a basis, we can go forward with some lightness of heart, I think, I would call it that, that allows us to both live our stories as we do and will, but also to go beyond them at the same time. However, there is violence and corruption in the world, and it can make us skeptical of this basic goodness, and can even lead to cynicism. And that's looking outward, and then when we look in, you know, at ourselves, at our own ignorance and mishaps, we can easily begin to doubt our own capacities to manifest this Buddha nature, and then we lose sight of this vast potential. And of course, this toxic doubt, then it transfers to our time on the cushion. And even though we understand the simplicity of the method of Zazen, for example, you know, returning again and again to this presence of life in ourselves, but our self-doubt confuses us and tells us that we're not doing it right, leading to more constriction and frustration. And we begin to see practice as a laborious self-improvement project, measuring our progress and our failures. And once again, we start to compare, you know, it's like, oh man, they all know the forms, and I'm going counterclockwise, and they're all going clockwise, or, you know, I only rang the bell once, and I was supposed to ring the bell twice, you know, we all know this stuff. So this is the comparison again, right? Now, I grew up as a Catholic, and when thinking about doubt for me, what came to mind is St. John of the Cross, who talked about the dark night of the soul. And there are different ways of interpreting this and seeing this dark night, and I'll express really only one of them. Anyway, what this is it's a period of really searing and excruciating doubt, which can last for many years. And I think all of us here are probably familiar with Mother Teresa, and you probably know, or maybe know, that she went through this for 50 years and continued to work as she did. And the way she described it was that she felt no presence of God whatsoever. So this is not specific to Christian mystics. And I read a bit about what Jack Kornfield had to say about this. And a couple of other practitioners from our own Zen tradition as well. But sometimes this was described more in our tradition as a dry spell, devoid of the aspiration to wake up. So Kornfield says it often appears after the student has been practicing for a number of years and has had some spiritual openings. But then, you know, of course, like everything, these heightened states will come, but then, of course, they pass away and they change. And the practitioner's early fantasies and expectations, you know, like I'm going to be enlightened tomorrow, or, you know, I'm going to be totally serene and my life is going to be totally sweet, well, those are not met. So this stage, he says, can touch some very painful and overwhelming places, and the student drops the practice altogether. However, if the student finds support in a teacher and a community, she can integrate this dark night into practice and emerge from that with joy and equanimity. Now, Joan Halifax is a person, I actually listened to her speak about this, who described her own suffering through this dark night. This happened during the time that she was initially setting up the Upaya Zen Center, and she was reluctant actually to go through it, whether she had the strength to go through it. But she uses the analogy of her Sonicare toothbrush to describe her process of the dark night. So I'm going to give you my own iteration of her Sonicare toothbrush story. Okay. She loved her Sonicare and was really excited to have one in the beginning. She was so excited about it that she brushed her teeth 4 or 5 times a day, thinking about the prospects of her cavity-free, dazzling white mouth. But eventually, the enthusiasm wore off. There were no more thrills, and 5 times a day grew to 4, then 3, then 2. But her good sense told her she shouldn't stop, and even though the thrill was gone, she just sallied on, brushing away, day to day, doing what was in front of her. Well, I don't know. It's not really in front of you. It's right there. Anyway, she grew content in her practice. She was at ease, and her teeth were happy. So in the end, she said she simply, what she did was really disavow her preferences. She continued to follow the teachings and put one foot in front of the other. And she didn't buy into the stories that she was wrong, or her teachers were wrong, or that the practice or life was wrong. After about 3 years, she went through this for 3 years, of heaviness, she confirmed what Thomas Merton had to say about this dry spot or this dark night. And these are Thomas Merton's words. True love and prayer are learned in the moment when prayer has become impossible and the heart has turned to stone. And then she herself, I have a quote from her about this too. She says, catastrophe is the essence of the spiritual path. A series of breakdowns allowing us to discover the threads that weave all of life into a whole cloth. So we may not necessarily reach extremes like this, but we can use our very doubt in profitable ways to doubt our own doubt. We can question the reality of our stories like she did. We can challenge the tactics we use to run away from our own pain and our own confusion. And we probably know all those. Blaming, of course, is one. We might overwork or overeat or over browse or Facebook or whatever it is we do to avoid ourselves and to avoid life. And in fact, we may even misuse our own spiritual teachings to simply create a stronger identity on the path. So we can begin to watch all of those things. And then, so once we've examined all of that, we can sit. We can just sit with our uncertainties and allow our doubts and demons in viscerally with great tenderness and loving kindness. Remembering that all beings suffer like this and that we are in concert with them. And if we can do this, we'll find the other side of doubt. This doubt that doubts doubt and uses it as a doorway to the unknown. Then our doubt, which used to be a hindrance, is now transformed, and this becomes our great doubt. And this is what gives fuel and vitality to our practice. Now, what is great doubt? We talk about it, and I didn't find any good definition for it, so you're gonna get mine. So, this is a doubt that grows out of a willingness and a hunger, as I see it, to really penetrate the mysteries of life, of death, of self, and just about everything in between. And it can also be uncomfortable, just the same way a doubt as a hindrance can be. And we have to get out of our base of knowledge that we've grown up with, that we've been educated with, that we've been just totally inculcated with. But we do have our own natural wonder. If we go back, you know, to our days of childhood, when we all had this sense of play and wonder and our curiosity, and we also have our great sorrows to spur us on in the pursuing this great doubt. So our job here with great doubt, as I see it, is to simply abide in the questions without clinging to the answers, and just letting the questions open ourselves up and reveal themselves. So I have a story here, a little bit of a story related to great doubt. I was at a friend's house a few weeks ago, and we were watching her toddler, Quinn. So Quinn was tossing some balls around, just playing while she and I were sitting there talking, and he was just so absolutely delighted at how this basketball, you know, would roll back and forth and come back to him, and how he would be into slamming it against the wall and hearing it, you know, oh, the noise was great, and how it stopped the conversation in the room. He really liked it when we stopped talking. And then how he watched how it would go around the corner and disappear and just go out of sight, and how, and also he liked to watch how it intimidated the cat, you know, the cat would run away and go crazy. So he went really off and on with this ball and some other ones for 2 hours, this kid, quietly, you know, it was incredible. He was totally absorbed in it. While my friend and I, we talked, and when we watched alternately. And I thought, now this is great doubt, the koan of the basketball. And as I see it, our Zen tradition really nourishes and encourages this spirit of inquiry. And to see this, I think, explicitly expressed in practice, we have koan study. And I think this is sort of a manifestation, you know, of the spirit of inquiry that we have. And Hakuin, who I read a bit about, who was a pretty fascinating guy, who was the 18th century Rinzai teacher, he said, at the bottom of great doubt lies great awakening. If you doubt fully, you will awaken fully. So Hakuin, he developed this systemized practice of koan study, a curriculum, with the repeated testings. You know, you go into the room and then you get dinged out because you probably got it wrong, and you can go through that for years and years. And he was known, I mean, his practice was extremely arduous. You know, he's one of these guys that sit there and he clenches teeth and didn't really work at it. But he was also known to have experienced what we would probably call today a mental breakdown as a result of the rigor that he applied to his practice. And he spent 2 years in rehab, so to speak. He went off with a Taoist hermit from the mountains and learned some breathing techniques and other stuff from this hermit fellow, and eventually got over it and returned to his practice. And I have to say, I'm not particularly a big fan of this type of practice, and that I am really happy to be here where we offer a gentler way through our Soto Zen practice. Which isn't to say that Dogen's way doesn't have its own challenges and frustrations. Dogen's talks and his writings are also koans in themselves. They're paradoxical, beautifully poetic, and filled with metaphors and images from his day. But we have a tendency, I think, we tease them out gently. We chant them, particularly on Saturday morning. We do the Fukan Zazengi and the Genjo Koan, when we chant that over and over again, and we have talks on them, and we reflect. And then by just sitting until they grow into us over time, and I feel like that's sort of like a graft to a tree. And the questions emerge, and certain phrases of his or other ones from the chants, they'll grab hold of us, and the responses over time morph and deepen in really unexpected circumstances and places. I think we've all probably experienced this over time with our practice. So unlike, however, Quinn's basketball, our koans aren't always so playful. They are the koans of our everyday life. Everyday life is our way and lineage. Suzuki Roshi said, enlightenment is not any particular stage that you attain. When you understand your life completely, that is enlightenment. So sometimes the teachings of our life might be painful, but with time and practice, we approach them like the basketball. Watch how they go up and down, slam up against the wall, then go around the corner and disappear, only to reappear again. So I'm going to cut myself off, actually, because I really do want to have a little go around the circle. But before I do that, I found I had pretty much, you know, put the talk away and let it go for a while, and I got onto the Everyday Zen site, which I do periodically. And on the homepage of Norman's site was a quote by Norman. And I want to go around the circle, but I want you to be thinking of this quote. I was going to copy it and pass it around to you so you could really look at it, but now you'll just have to remember because, like, this is a test. So, anyway. So, here's what he says. It's necessary to keep things honest. In order to have some faith, you absolutely have to doubt. You have to wonder whether yesterday's truth still applies today. You have to ask if it does or not. Be willing to tear down today's truth to find something, if anything, behind it. This makes life and religion alive. You want me to read it one more time? Okay. It's necessary to keep things honest. In order to have some faith, you absolutely have to have doubt. You have to wonder whether yesterday's truth still applies today. You have to ask if it does or not. Be willing to tear down today's truth to find something, if anything, behind it. This makes life and religion alive. So you don't really have to respond to that. I'm just throwing it out there. You can, you know, I'm sure all of us, I mean, these hindrances and kleshas, they're universal. I'm sure we have all had doubts in different ways. And maybe they're great doubts, and maybe they're small doubts. So whatever comes up, and again, if you don't wish to speak, just bow and pass, that's fine. So, well, why don't we won't put Nick on the spot. We'll put Tim on the spot first, and we'll go around the circle that way. What?
Yeah. I actually don't understand what you want us to say.
Oh, well, anything you want about doubt. first of all. And that's why I read Norma's quote thinking that we could respond if you chose to respond to that particular quote. And if you have had doubts of your own, great doubt or small doubts. That's a little broad, but go for it.
Well, something there maybe about like sort of like trying to make something happen. It feels kind of forced and